Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Today, we're meeting with Gwen Adsett, and we're very fortunate to meet with Gwen, really, because Gwen, after all, is a public figure, often on the radio, has written many, many articles and books. And I was reflecting earlier on today, Gwen, you're a national treasure, which is a funny thing, really, to be saying about a forensic psychiatrist who's spent so much time working with patients who have committed terrible crimes. But nevertheless, there it is. And I think it's because of the way in which you've been able to put across very difficult message with charm and conviction. Now, I was reading a brief article you wrote in the journal Hectoan International.
Strange article. I don't know. They're an interesting journal, and they specialize in the humanities in healthcare. And so I've always, they often have some quite interesting things. So that's
this was interesting. And you were mentioning Broadmoor's relative isolation from its surrounding community. And this reminded me of my own personal debt of gratitude to you, because about 10 years ago, when my professional life was at a particularly low ebb, you allowed me to come and see you at Broadmoor. And at that time, I was without a car, so it was a difficult journey. I had to get a train to Reading and then another one to Crowthorne, I think it was, and then a bus to the village, and then a long walk from the village to the hospital, which was actually a beautiful walk. And of course, the time that you gave me then was both very helpful and highly memorable. So thank you very much for that. And moving on, I thought it'd be helpful to talk less about your own background, your own personal background, and focus instead on some other particular areas of your experience and expertise. So you've worked at one of our most venerable institutions, Broadmoor Hospital, for many years, and I gather you're working there again now. Can you tell us something about what your relationship has been to these specialist services that offer an approach to treating those who are detained in secure settings? What's it been like for you?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and actually the way you put it is particularly nice, because I think that I have indeed had a relationship with secure services, but that, like in many enduring relationships, that relationship has changed, and partly the secure services that I've worked in have changed. So in the time that I've worked as a forensic psychiatrist, I think forensic services have changed very significantly, and attitudes towards forensic services and offending have changed. And I'd be interested to know whether you guys have a similar experience in the context of prison. But, and also, of course, I've changed as a person, and, you know, in many, many ways. You know, I'm, you know, sort of older, more experienced, have life events at home which have made a big difference to me. Just those ordinary human transformations that happen. So that the way I do forensic psychiatry and psychotherapy now is not the way perhaps that I did it 10 years ago, and not the way I did it 20 years ago. So, and I think it's a good point, really, to think of ourselves as having these relationships with our workplaces, and perhaps particularly these closed environments where you need, in which you become a member of something, but you also get to walk away from it. And I think that one of the things that I suppose has been a very important part of my life in secure institutions is that I go in and I come out. And that's a bit different, perhaps, to certainly the people who reside there, but even for the staff who spend hours and hours of shifts, will spend more time there than with their own families often. My relationship has been, that of a kind of elderly relative, I sometimes think. or some kind of carer, I suppose, some kind of carer to both the patients, but also to the staff and perhaps also the institution.
That's an interesting way of putting it. An elderly carer doesn't quite ring true to me, I have to say, knowing you and seeing you now. But it's bringing to my mind something. When I used to work in Oxford doing lots of one-to-one work, I obviously met quite a lot of academics. And several, I remember, would describe how, even though they were there, they didn't feel they had a place there. They always thought, well, my position, I'm a professor, I should have some power and influence, but they could never find it. It always seemed to slip away from them. And I wondered whether that resonated with you at all.
Yes, I suppose it's partly because my role has changed and kept changing over time. But because I trained as a forensic psychiatrist, and I moved over to psychotherapy mainly because I could see that if I didn't do that, I would be a kind of case manager all my life. Now, I don't have a problem with that role, but increasingly, the people who get face-to-face time with the patient are people who are not the consultant forensic psychiatrist. The consultant forensic psychiatrist is often, you know, has a role, coordinates things, oversees things, but doesn't necessarily have that face-to-face time with patients. And so I wanted to be the one who spoke to the patients. I didn't want my junior doctors to be. So, and also I'd been doing my research had a big impact on me too. I'd gone to the Institute of Psychiatry to do research on trauma, and the research that I got involved in there took me into looking at different kinds of responses to trauma. Why do some people have a big response to trauma, and why do some seem to sail through it with, you know, with less distress? So, and that's really where I first started getting interested in attachment theory. And my interest in attachment theory is really what made me want to think more about how to be a psychotherapist. And Bowlby's ideas about developing a secure base, of course, spoke to my interest in being a therapist in secure settings. You know, attachment theory is one of the few psychological theories that actually uses the language of security. So I did this training in attachment theory, and particularly about how to use the adult attachment interview. And then I started doing that with some kinds of offenders and got really interested in that work. And then I got a chance to work at Broadmoor to finish off my psychotherapy training while still looking after some patients. And that was really helpful to me. So I was So my role within the hospital, you know, has often changed. Sometimes I've been a responsible clinician, and I've worked in the hospital at times when being a responsible clinician was an important role, was a job with influence, as you say, coming back to the point you made about influence. But I think, and then I was working mainly as a psychotherapist in a complex institution, and there the influence we had was very indirect, I think. It was something about modeling a kind of way of thinking and a way of engaging. And then, of course, since 2010, I think it would be fair to say that the role of the doctors has been greatly minimized in all healthcare settings, but perhaps particularly in mental health care, where the responsible clinician now, I think, has a very odd, very interesting role, and certainly is not. It's not seen, I think, as being a very important role. And so, well, it is important. Of course, it's important because it has legal responsibility. But in terms of how decisions are made, it's certainly not like it was. The idea of the psychiatrist, the doctor will make the main decisions and everybody will follow in their wake. Not that that's a particularly attractive model to me, but there's almost like the reverse, that the RC is the least important person, I think, in some ways.
It sounded, Gwen, so you were saying that you needed that the psychotherapy role was actually something that you possibly needed for your own well-being, in terms of your professional role, that might have added greater meaning to your professional life?
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, I had been interested in psychotherapy. Even before I started training in medicine, I'd read a bit about psychological therapies and then when I came to train as a doctor, the psychiatry that I learned was fairly sort of basic psychiatry, and I was quite interested in the standard, as one often at the beginning of a medical training as a psychiatrist you carry your medical training with you, so it's very natural to think that way to start with. But you know, you don't have to spend long in as a psychiatrist before you realize that kind of model really doesn't do justice to the complexity of humans' minds and relationships. So, but also I struggled with all sorts of stuff, for want of a better word, when I was training. So I was in therapy when I was a junior doctor, and having that experience, of course, made it much more possible, you know, for me to think about how to apply psychodynamic relational ways of thinking to secure settings. And also, I was very, very lucky to, because I was working in a context where there were other people thinking in similar ways. I trained at St. George's and in a department where there was a lot of people who were also asking similar questions, who had similar ideas, and who were saying, well, you know, what is the connection between these patients' terrible childhoods and their extraordinary capacity for cruelty now? And also, what is happening in the people who don't seem to have those terrible childhoods, but still seem to have a capacity for terrorizing people or intimidating people? So I was very, very fortunate to do my forensic psychiatry training in an environment that was very open and to these sorts of questions. And not only psychodynamic psychotherapy, but all kinds of psychological therapy, and also sociology and criminology. There were people asking those sorts of questions in the department that I trained in. So our referral meetings would be quite interesting. And it was a world away. It was a world away from what's the diagnosis, you know, double whatever meds they're on, goodbye. that's a crude description, but I'm sure we've all been there in a kind of conversation where we'll fiddle with the meds and that'll be it, and we, in a way which just, you know, it rarely feels right in my experience.
That was at George's,
yeah,
where you did your training. And did you find that same kind of culture moved with you when you went to Broadmoor?
Well, again, I think I was very fortunate that I went to Broadmoor at a time with two things. One is that Broadmoor had a tradition since 1941 of employing psychodynamic psychotherapists, both Murray Cox and Peter Lewis. Peter Lewis in particular, who I think worked at Grendon.
He did, yes.
As well, in fact, I think that might have been his main job, or he was there a couple of days a week, I think. I mean, perhaps Peter, even more than Murray in a way, was one of the first forensic psychotherapists in terms of actually going into prisons. Perhaps he and Bob Hinshelwood in the Scrubs. Max Glatt perhaps a bit as well, but those, they were the real pioneers of psychotherapy, I think, with prisoners, with offenders of various sorts. But of course I was very taken with Murray Cox's presentations, and you know, the mixture of the literary interest and also his, you know, his evident sort of compassion and very, just a very, what he always described as kind of light touch. And he was also very thoughtful about the institution as an organism, really, you know, about pointing out that he might come and do a group on the ward, but the patients had lives. All the other hours of the day and of the week were very important to what happened to them. And if he didn't think about that, he was missing something. And so he was very thoughtful about conveying a kind of systemic approach. He didn't write about it intriguingly very much. He wrote, of course, much more about metaphor and that sort of thing. But in fact, he was his systemic and what we might think of as a more organizational approach. Think about the dynamics of the organization was very, very helpful to me because it meant that that gave me, back to your question, Naomi, gave me a context for thinking about the men I was working with in terms of not only, you know, their internal worlds, but the world of the ward they were living on and the world of the ward within the hospital and the world of the hospital within society, you know, and Pat Galway, and I'd learned from Pat Galway that, you know, this idea that I think this old idea that prisons and special hospitals, as they were then known, that prisons and secure, but become the place where we put all our bad objects. So, and then we feel better. If all the bad stuff's there, then we think, well, that's good, all the bad stuff's there, so it can't be anywhere else. and that's tidy and neat. And then they are people who are literally out of sight and therefore literally out of mind. Out of whose mind, of course, is the other question. So to be able to think systemically about my patients was just incredibly freeing. You know, if you don't think, I mean, the thing that puzzles me greatly is why doesn't everybody think that way? Because if you just think about it in terms of they've got the schizophrenia and the schizophrenia made them kill their mum. If you just think about it that way, life is so much harder. if you don't see Jim as a man who you meet because he's been the architect of a tragedy that he, which has changed his life forever as well as the lives of other people. And then the question becomes now, who or what will you do, Jim, with your one life? What will you do? And that more kind of more existential, I mean, that more existential approach makes, I think, life much easier in long-term residential care.
Yes, we were talking to Lorna Rhodes the other day, and she was describing the work that she did with a prison official in Washington State, and his particular area was the, you know, the high secure area of the prison, and he transformed it really by teaching his staff that the men there were human. So human was the word that he used a lot. And that's how he managed to improve a better kind of style of interaction and relationships there, which is fairly similar, I think, to what you're describing. No.
Go on, sorry.
No.
Well, I was just, I mean, David will maybe remember this from attending Murray Cox's lectures, but he had a wonderful quote from one of his female patients, one of the women who'd been in the hospital, who said to him, "If you could talk to me the more human way, the night would come in more slowly." Mm. So, and this was a woman who, and Murray used to quote this as an example of the extraordinary beauty and metaphorical complexity of language of people who are psychotic, because he was very interested in the possibilities of therapy for people who are psychotic. But that lovely phrase, the more human way, is exactly what you're talking about, David, and what Lorna's talking about, and what I think all of us who are trying to make custodial or secure environments more therapeutic, it must start there, mustn't it? It's got to start from the premise that we are more alike than we are different. And these are people who find themselves like Dante in, you know, in the middle of their lives in a dark wood. Mm. And how did they get there? And where will they go next? These become questions of what Paul Tillich calls ultimate concern, don't they? What is going to happen next? And And we're trying to walk alongside people, aren't we? Particularly in the Fens, you must see this, the people who are trying to decide whether they're going to let you walk along with them and take up the offer of help that you've got. You've got an offer to make. And the question is, can they let themselves use it? And what will it cost them?
Yeah, and it's frightening. So, you know, when you know something so well, you're used to that position. It's frightening to give up on that, isn't it?
Yes.
I want to go back to something you just said there about, I suppose it was a kind of curiosity about, well, why would someone choose to use such a simplistic model of human beings? It feels more frustrating, but I was thinking that in some ways it seems as though society needs to be able to other people for its own well-being. You know, if you think of society as the bigger thing, I wondered if you thought that was necessary for society, and whether people who get othered in this way, you know, they're seen as being dispensable in some way because they're serving a purpose for society.
Well, definitely. And I also think that we know, don't we, from our work with people who have complex sort of problems and complex traumas, that often the best way to survive is to take up a very rigid, polarized view of the world, which offers a kind of stability. You know, the black and white, the bad, good, you know, these are sort of fixed poles that give you a kind of orientation in the world. And it's back to that idea of, you know, our locator, if I know where the badness is, then that will make me feel safe. And as you say, it requires a lot of courage to let go of that certainty, stand in a kind of ambiguity, and be willing to consider that there may be something of the night in all of us. I mean, that shadow side of all of us, I always came to this work firmly convinced that everybody has a capacity to be cruel and unpleasant in the right circumstances. You know, I certainly know that I can be cruel and unpleasant in the right circumstances. And although I haven't yet murdered and disemboweled anybody, you know, it's only a matter of time. But, you know, I mean, when I was running a therapy group for people who killed, you know, we the therapists used to say to the men in the group, you know, everybody here in the group has killed somebody close to them, except the therapist, and there's still plenty of time for the therapist. But we wanted to try and just emphasize that capacity for cruelty, is that shadow side, is there in everyone. And the people who have acted it out, that's a tragedy for them as well as it is for other people. And the only way to make good out of a tragedy is to try and invest hopefully in doing something different. But as you said, Naomi, it takes enormous courage and hope and trust to be able to even allow yourself a new thought. And that new thought may be so painful that you might need 6 months to recover from having had that new thought.
I was thinking that also for the staff, in terms of what a powerful intervention, you know, to be able to see the likeness and the potential for greater likeness, you know, that takes, I think, quite brave staff to be able to even reflect on that.
Yes, it does.
And to get rid of that notion of othering, because I think actually in forensic services, so much of it is about othering people within those services, you know, just reflecting it's a repetition, isn't it, of their childhood and then wider society. Just thinking about how much impact that could have on people's well-being and resourcefulness as they cope with painful therapy, to have that burden of being othered taken off them.
Yes. Well, it's a bit, this takes us into the issue of shame, doesn't it, I think, and a sense of a kind of shame as a kind of social scrutiny. If shame is one of the social emotions that you think you read in other people's eyes, where you think you know how people are seeing you in a kind of ranking evaluation of people. And we know that that sense of shame is can be just excruciating for people to take on board. And again, David and I have certainly been present listening to Jim Gilligan talk about this and the role of shame in the genesis of violence. And I think that shame is one of those emotions that is very difficult to talk about and actually quite difficult therapeutically to know how to address, but it must be something. It's one of the areas where groups must be a first line, because actually you can't do much with shame, I think, in individual work. You can talk about how difficult it is, and you can validate and you can support. I'm not saying that individual therapy isn't kindly in that way, but if you're going to work on shame, you're going to have to take that risk to come out and be seen by others whose minds you can't control, which is and this is where I think the whole mentalization model has been very, very helpful, I think, to make you realize that other people's minds are always going to be slightly opaque to you and you can't control them. And that's part of being a social animal. But you can't shame, you have to come out and be seen. And it takes enormous courage. And again, you must see this all the time, the men that just get so far and just can't take that last step to be seen.
Absolutely. And I think because we do offer, you know, 5 years of individual therapy as well as group work, but often the individual therapy works as kind of a rehearsal for what's going to happen in group. If you disclose things and work on them in individual sessions, they then get the confidence from the therapist's response to be able to, maybe I won't get annihilated.
Yeah. And I think that model of group and individual is really strong for people with complex psychopathology. I really do, because I think that the individual therapy also provides a kind of nurturing and just a reassurance that it's all right to feel mad and bad and peculiar and I this is Bowlby's secure base, isn't it? The individual work acts as a kind of secure base for you to refuel and reorganize yourself. So you go back to the group, to your work. But then it's a really important role, isn't there, to integrate the individual and the group together, so things don't get split off or lost or pretend or deceived or encapsulated into a kind of sort of psychic space where something painful or difficult is hidden. But I think again, that's why I think the mentalization model, you know, has been very helpful. The MBT model has been very helpful for giving us kind of framework for talking and thinking about that. You know, it has been helpful to have somebody doing a kind of empirical study of something that most of us have been working in this field for a while. We think, oh, wow, you know, we can't prove it, but we're pretty sure it works. And then, you know, Peter and Anthony come along and do a bit of work that helps to actually ground us in a kind of empiricism, which is helpful. I just think it's really helpful. You know, I think and particularly when it comes to working with people with personality disorder, and you know, all three of us have lived through a time when personality disorder was something that, you know, just didn't get treatment at all. You know, I mean, I well remember as a junior psychiatrist being told quite explicitly, you know, not to admit somebody had a personality disorder, not even to engage with them. You know, I was told off by my boss when I was a junior psychiatrist. Why was I, you know, just don't do that thing. I mean, you know, they were not without their reason, but they didn't have a context. They don't have the kind of context. Now we might say don't admit them, but for very different reasons. Not the simple, it's nothing to do with us. That's not real mental illness. That's not real mental suffering. It's nothing to do with us, Gov. And that's been an enormous change, I think, academically and practically for me in the last 20 years, I would say, made a huge difference to my working life.
Can I just bring you back to the institution and you have already approached this, but I'm going to quote something you wrote. You write these beautiful sentences, so they're going to come back and visit you now. So you wrote, it was the same article actually in the obscure Chicago journal. You wrote, public vengefulness, though human and understandable, tends to invest offender identities with a sticky quality. Beautiful, beautiful description of something. My wonder was, how did Broadmoor deal with that, given that, you know, the public are not just outside Broadmoor, but they're inside Broadmoor as well. So these dynamics apply there as well.
Yeah. How did they deal with them? Well, I think that they dealt with them. When I first went to Broadmoor, it was a very particular kind of institution, I think, in the great sort of English tradition of Victorian institutions, sort of big red brick walls and sort of certain tests to get in. And then when you get in there, you stay in there for a number of years and then you move on from there, perhaps to another institution. And I have to say that when I first went there, it reminded me very much of a sort of cross between HMP Wandsworth and my old school. And there was something of that same kind of, we've been here forever, we do stuff with minds, you know, hopefully you leave here in a good place, kind of a feel about it. And that same air when you walk into a prison that you don't know, or an institution that you don't know, of everything happening behind the scenes. You know, you as a visitor, you walk in and there are these spaces and you see people walking purposefully about. And there's this sense of activity going on that you can't see anything, but it's sort of there. A bit like a sort of anthill or a beehive. It's all going on inside. So to come back to your question, I think the way that the staff used to deal with it was to have a very specific Broadmoor staff identity. So when I started at Broadmoor, there were literally still men in white coats. I mean, there were staff, and the Prison Officers Association was still very important. A lot of people were actually still members of the POA. Nurses were a very small minority and not exactly looked down on, but were sort of seen as not really very important. You know, but the men, and they were largely men who were nurses there, saw themselves very much as agents of law and order, I think, as well as well-being. But well-being was very much in a kind of sort of muscular, we're going to get you sort of, you know, lifting bricks and, you know, building, you know, sort of lamps and sort of that kind of, there was a kind of sort of muscular kind of rehabilitation. But I think the way that the staff dealt with it is that we are special staff. We have special skills for dealing with these very special patients in this very special hospital. And also there was a kind of camaraderie around that. And I think also that idea of having secrets. I don't know that the fact that we know secrets about people that nobody else can know. I think that was also part of the camaraderie and the specialness. And I mean, there was a kind of ordeal for initiates, which was to attend a lecture from the security department, which was intended to scare you witless. And it always involved pictures of weapons that the patients had made and they'd only just found last week, you know. And I remember the very first time I went through this, you know, there was quite a lot of, you mustn't turn your back on them for a moment or they'll have you, you know, this kind of stuff. So I think there's something of that kind of performance, sort of Goffman, absolutely Goffman-like kind of performance and the taking up of roles. So we come back to where was my role in this? So the nursing staff had their roles in managing the wards and they owned the wards. They were like small fiefdoms. And when I first started, we were told that we had to ring the wards before we came and get agreement that we could come. There was, you know, but I'm the doctor on the ward. No, you ring up the ward and tell them, that you're, see if it's all right for you to come, that kind of thing. And then that changed. I mean, that changed and it became much more like a regular psychiatric hospital. There was a shift. And I was, the other reason that I was lucky because I worked at a time when the Blair government got in and there was just a lot more investment in the NHS in mental health service. So there was money to develop things. And that coincided with, it didn't coincide, it was presumably allowed for spending on a kind of much more traditional kind of medical model, and the idea that Broadmoor was going to be like any other psychiatric hospital, albeit with security, but it was going to be a psychiatric hospital treating psychiatric disorders by psychiatrists with mental health teams. So I think that leaves the nurses with a bit of a quandary, David. I think coming back to your question, I think the nurses still do struggle with this, although in fact, interestingly enough, I think the junior doctors do too. You know, I get staff and junior doctors who say, I don't want to know what they've done. Otherwise it will get in the way of my caring for them. And again, while I understand that, I think it's a mistake. I think it's fundamentally a mistake that actually, because otherwise you can't help this person with what they've done. If you don't want to know, then that's a very powerful message that you don't want to know. You don't want to see their shadow side. You want to only know their suffering side, or the bit of them that has tummy pain or or that sort of stuff. You don't want to know a different kind of pain.
Absolutely. And I know certainly at the Fens, that was also our experience when we first started. Officers say, well, I choose not to know what people have done. And you're thinking, well, how can you make sure that you're playing a role in terms of rehabilitation, but also just in terms of risk assessment? How can you know? And, you know, the whole, obviously there's no room there for the concept of offence paralleling and mm-hmm. thinking about how behaviours might be symbolised. But yeah, it really seems quite short-sighted. And one of my colleagues mm-hmm. has got an expression of talking about people, prisons existing and expecting people to leave their offending behaviour at the gate and then pick it up on their way out, back out again, as long as they're model prisoners whilst they're inside. And I think it lends itself to that, really. Mm. But I was curious about something that you said about the staff taking on these kind of roles. And, you know, increasingly we know that being authentic plays a real role in terms of well-being and, you know, our own resilience and well-being. And so therefore, when people take on these stereotyped roles, whether ultimately that actually undermines their own well-being, if they're having to go to work and take on this persona to get through their shift, do you think that makes them more vulnerable?
Well, I guess it poses a problem, doesn't it? I think because if you think about the question that you asked me, David, about the sort of vengefulness that there might be in the staff, then I think their role and identity as Broadmoor, well, I'm going to go with Broadmoor, but it could be anyway, as secure hospital nurses. And as then they had, you know, insignia, they'd like the uniform that goes with that and the roles, helps to, for them, I think it helped to keep them in role as healthcare professionals. But I think it also helped to keep a kind of barrier. It helped them to deal with any sense of vulnerability or any sense of, you know, sort of vengefulness. Or I wonder, the difficulty, it's interesting because I've been having this conversation, I have this conversation a lot with the nursing staff on the ward where I work at present, which is about how to be authentic about what you feel about something that somebody said, or without being too open, you know, being so open that in fact you end up asking the prisoner or the patient to have to sort of help you manage whatever your feelings are going on at present. And it is a profound dilemma, I think, because you want to be authentic, but it has to be within a boundary. And I've come to the conclusion that it's something that you have to learn as part of a kind of way of style of communicating. And of course, this is where supervision comes in, because then I often think that there is that about supervision, which is of trying to explore, what do you say when? when the patient says, you know, when the patient says, why don't you sod off to your useless life and your pitiful pay? What do you say? What does the good professional say? What does a good prison officer say? What does a good HCA say to something which is designed to hurt you? You know, and you feel hurt and you want to say something that is truthful to the offensiveness of what was said, but is not going to make it worse. And of course you can ignore, but that's not very therapeutic. And it also, it's not very authentic. Somebody, person A, is trying to cause hurt to person B, but person B has the job of trying to make that into something therapeutic, if they possibly can, or at least not anti-therapeutic.
Isn't it possible to reflect back on that hurt in some way take a role that symbolises restorative justice, that you, in that moment, that staff member is the victim, even if that doesn't mean they have to behave like a victim, but actually to acknowledge that was a really hurtful thing that you've just said to me when I'm trying to do my best by you.
And I think that, I think that's absolutely right, but people have to be able to say those kinds of things with confidence. And that comes with time and practice and you also have to be in a cultural milieu that's going to support you. That most people are going to do that. Yeah. And if they don't do that, they'll come back to a session where they say, you never guess what I said to Jim. Jim said this to me and I lost it and said, why don't you sod off? And you get to talk about that and people don't punish you or suspend you, or they just say, oh, okay, what happened here? And hopefully you get Jim in and we talk about it as well. Do you see what I mean? You know, but you have to have, the milieu has to make it possible to do that. What's really tricky is where you get half a media. And I think that's a little bit of what we have in secure psychiatric services. There's a bit of half a media where the staff are trying to be therapeutic and trying not to react to hurts or offence or anger or wish to hurt themselves, but then can respond very inappropriately to other kinds of boundary push, can medicalize them, you know, or just, you know, IR1 seclusion, you know, sort of, you know, or even just the straightforward medical, oh, he's not well, doctor, he needs his medication increasing. Why? Well, he was very angry with Henry this morning on the shift, you know. How was he angry? Well, he glared at Henry, you know, as Henry went past. And said, well, okay. And, so you know it's that sort of stuff, you know. And also the downside of the medical milieu is the hospital milieu is that, doctor, will you come and fix this patient because we don't like how he's operating at present, so will you, you know, it's that old Sazian thing about, you know, can you just change the channel so the picture is different. But it is very human and understandable. I'm on record as saying, you know, long-term residential secure care is a very, very particular type of human intervention, a really specific kind of care, which needs much better recognition that it is that, you know, it's not just kind of, you know, we just put people here because we don't like them. We're actually going to, this is something that you're doing to them, ideally doing with them. And it needs careful thought if you're going to do that.
Can I move you on? I'm aware we're taking up lots and lots of your time, and I feel I've hardly started. But I was just thinking that one of the reasons that Naomi and I started to do this podcast was because we were aware that there were some places that seemed to go on for a long time. You know, you think of Grendon been going for 60 years or something. The Henderson went for quite a long while. Barlini, Max Glatch, obviously Broadmoor. And even those that got closed, and those that got closed are an interesting kind of sub area of thought. But even those that got closed seemed to live on in the minds of people, either in the minds of academics or the minds of former patients or residents there. So there's something interesting about those particular institutions, and that's what struck us. So I wanted to ask you something, and this may be a bit controversial, and you may want to say nothing. but one major development at Broadmoor, of course, was the building of the paddocks. And I wondered what effect that had on the institution, the total institution there.
Well, I don't think it was so much the building of the paddocks as the introduction of a specialist program for personality disorder, as if Broadmoor had not been treating people with personality disorder for a long time. I think that was one thing that was very difficult. And then the other thing that was very difficult was that the way that the service was set up was that it didn't really make good enough use of the existing knowledge base and culture that there was. And there was a lot of experience, particularly amongst the little, not so little cohort of us who'd been to Holland and, worked with colleagues there, who'd listened to talks from Dutch colleagues and German colleagues and people who had some idea about this for some time. And it was very difficult to get a sort of foot in the door. And if I tell you, I mean, one of the most painful things about the opening of the paddocks of the DSPD unit was the idea that these were going to be the most dangerous men that we'd ever admitted to Broadmoor. But the staff who recruited were all people who'd come from the high intensity unit, who were used to dealing with patients who were, randomly and intermittently violent. But of course, the guys we admitted were nothing like that. Their cruelty and violence was all relational. And the staff were on the back foot from the get-go, because they were waiting for the assaults, the physical assaults to happen. But of course, those physical assaults didn't happen. Nothing like that happened. What happened were increasingly egregious boundary violations. And in those happy days to come, when we're in the pub, three of us, I will tell you stories about egregious boundary violations, which I couldn't possibly talk about on any kind of public space. But on a more serious point, I mean, I do think that places like Broadmoor, and it is interesting that Broadmoor is rebuilt. This was the thing that I think is interesting about Broadmoor's new building, is that this was an opportunity to give it a new name. And I think it's very interesting that the high secure hospitals have not been rebranded with new names. All sorts of other toxic places have had new names. Grendon, I think, doesn't need a new name because it's always been committed to trying to grow something positive, and it holds that very richly. And I think to some extent, Barlinnie too, standing up for something a bit mad, bit crazy, bit chaotic, but heart absolutely in the right place. But Broadmoor, has always had this kind of madness, cruelty, behind the walls, nothing you can do kind of stuff, hopeless kind of quality. And I think when Broadmoor was built, this was a great opportunity to rebrand and rename. And I think it's a great pity we didn't rename, because I think that was an opportunity to let go of a way of thinking about high secure care, let that go into the 19th century or even the early to mid-20th, where it belongs, leave it there and go into the 21st century with a new idea of what we do in high security, which is tough, believe me. What we do in Broadmoor, the work that gets done there is tough. Mm. The men we look after are very, very disturbed, and the things they've done are awful. And it's awful, and they're awful to digest.
One of the things that David and I spoke about when we were just thinking about starting this podcast was how there are some people that work in forensic services where you can just, there's a cynicism and a jadedness about them, and it's really taken its toll working in forensic services for so long. And I think what's really interesting about you, Gwen, even though I've never met you, everyone who hears mention of your name always talks about what a lovely, warm person you are. And that kind of bucks against the idea of what people think of when they think about people who've worked around forensic services for a very long time. And just wondering how you hold on to that sense of compassion and generosity of spirit within yourself, which isn't easy when you're faced with the kind of like darker side of people's characters.
Well, I, like most people, I think you can only do this work with the help of other people. I think that I see myself, you know, very much as one of a group of people, like-minded people, all working towards a good end. And I'm happy to be part of a community, people trying to do our best. Sometimes we don't get very far, sometimes we make mistakes, but I'd rather be in the team that's trying than the team that's not. So standing up for the possibility of goodness, standing up for the possibility of hope, I'd rather do that. It's that old thing about, you know, I'd rather light a candle than curse the darkness. Yeah. And I learned that from other people. And so it's great to share it with others. I really believe in the possibilities of transformation, even, you know, maybe not for everybody, maybe not for all time, but I think it's definitely something to believe in. And I keep my expectations low. I accept that people do horrible things, but I also know that most people don't. And that is something to celebrate. That is really something to celebrate and to be pleased about and to enjoy. And I think paying proper attention to those things. I think this is one of the things, of course, that's making lockdown very difficult for people, because we're not able to spend the time with the kind of things that provide us with a kind of emotional nourishment, like live music of whatever sort, live theatre, just having meals with friends. Those kinds of things that are hugely emotionally nourishing. And just a reminder that the people that we met are actually a tragic minority of people who got left behind as children and have lost themselves now. But yeah, I'd rather be trying than not, I think.
Okay, just to bring us towards the end, because you've done many things in your time, not least is in the field of ethics. You studied and written widely about the field of ethics, and I wondered what it was took you into that particular field, and then how you kind of, I hate this word, but I'm going to say it anyway, operationalize it.
Yes, that is a hideous word, David. I'm surprised. I'm surprised to hear it from your lips, I have to say. I did medical law and ethics as a diploma when I was still a junior psychiatrist, because I'd actually heard Ian Kennedy's Reith lectures way back when, about the power of doctors. And the power of doctors to make decisions over people's lives. And I remember as a junior medical student huffing and puffing and thinking, what does this man know about anything? And then I got onto the wards and I saw doctors making decisions which had huge impacts on people's lives. But I saw that those people weren't always consulted or weren't in a position to be consulted or were treated, if not unkindly or even rudely, but just somehow, the patient doesn't need to know about this. and I saw things that, and I thought that really struck me as unfair and unjust and somehow dishonest. I mean, so I went to do this diploma in medical law and ethics, and it was absolutely fascinating, completely fascinating. It's at King's. And then it became a master's degree. So I stayed on and did the master's degree. And that was really very, very interesting. It had comparatively little in it about mental health, but it got me going with thinking about those things. But that then, and that was really in a way what took me into forensic psychiatry, because then I became interested in, well, given that I mean, psychiatry has this enormous capacity for, what's the word I want, you know, for medicalizing deviance, but also imposing social norms in the name of health and so on and so forth. All that, all those old kind of anti-psychiatric concerns, they concerned me too when I was a junior psychiatrist. So what I liked about forensic psychiatry was there was something very clear about what the primary task was. The primary task was to help somebody who's done a bad thing not do it again. and as part of that, that their mental health would be better. And which came first would be a kind of chicken and egg thing. That, you know, the mental health would be better and then they might be less risky, but they might be less risky and their mental health would improve. And so there was a complex interdigitation between the wish to be cruel and to destroy and the capacity for health. So that's how the ethics really took me to forensic psychiatry, and it's been a very important part of how I think about, you know, trying to make a, what is it, what is a good decision. And I think many of our people that we work with, would benefit from studying from sort of ethical workshops. I've often wondered whether, I mean, you may already do this in the fence, but I've often wondered whether prisons might want to think about running sort of ethics 101, just to look at how complicated it can be to decide what the right thing is to do. It's sometimes when it's very clear what the wrong thing is to do, but what is the right thing? Is not often not as easy as all that.
No, I guess it takes you into that grey ground again, doesn't it, which people really struggle with when, you know, forensics is quite often that need to be in a black and white state of thinking, and much harder to think about the grey.
Well, it solves anxiety, doesn't it? Much as we think the violence solves anxiety. You know, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do. I'll kill her, that's what I'll do. And that will be a kind of solution. And people then, I don't know whether you've had this, but you know, I've talked to so many people for whom they then thought about it and ruminated and it grew and it grew and it became obvious. Because obviously the only thing to do was to kill this person. And then they kill them and, oh my, what have I done? What have I done? How did I ever think that killing this person was going to be a solution? And what, you know, what else could I have done? Well, of course, is a very painful thing to think about as well as, but I think those kind of black and white solutions are often very much part of what, you know, bring our people into the tragedy that they commit.
Finally, I think you're involved with an organisation called Mindfulness for Doctors.
I am.
This presumably links up with everything else we've been talking about, particularly the ethical background, does it?
Well, yes. Well, there's, as always, a slightly long, rambly story behind this. But I became interested in mindfulness practices because I was suffering from chronic depression. So I'd been on antidepressants on and off, and then I came across some research that suggested that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy reduced the risk of relapse in chronic depression. So I thought, well, that's interesting. It's not often you get, you know, there aren't that many psychological therapies that have a kind of, you know, research base behind them. So I went off and did a bit of, you know, study around that, and I discovered the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy program in Oxford. And I was very fortunate that my then boss was also trained in mindfulness practitioner, and he said, oh yeah, you go off and do that. So I did that, and I was very lucky. But I think what that did for me was, of the many things it did for me, and it did make a big difference to the way I think about the internal, about our, not only our internal world, but how the interaction of the internal world with the external world. But I think what it did for me was to take the idea of compassion seriously, perhaps really seriously, and about the idea of self-compassion. And of course, you know, very clear, of course, instantly, that so many of our people who we work with have no self-compassion whatsoever, but also the idea that as carers, we probably need to treat our own hurt and shame and offense and anger and cruelty with a kind of compassion. And so those mindfulness practices, so the Mindfulness for Doctors really came about as a way of just inviting doctors to take some time out to be kind to themselves, to be kind to the parts of them that are fed up and cruel and tired and mean. And just give a bit of space for people to, again, really focus your attention on something healthy rather than unhealthy. And there's, of course, much more to say than that. But it was very important for me, and I think a very rich complement to the psychodynamic tradition in which I've been trained, and I think a very helpful one.
And the pictures on the website look great fun as well.
Yes. No. We absolutely do. It's not a mindfulness boot camp. It's very much about going. We usually go to this lovely place called Amadan, which is in Somerset. Although we sometimes go to Launde Abbey in Leicestershire, which is beautiful in a different way. But Amadan it's just a very, very pleasant place to be. Very benign kind of place. And for those of us working in forensic settings, I think it's just really important to take time out and be in benign places where you just can enjoy the pleasantness of the here and now, and how rich that is. Very important, I think. Restorative justice.
Yeah.
And we'll post the link to that on the website.
Oh, yeah.
People can check that out.
Oh, anyone can go to Amadan and spend a weekend there. You know, they're very reasonably priced, and you get lovely food, and you can just go there and do absolutely nothing at all. And I thoroughly recommend going to Amadan and doing nothing at all.
Good. Naomi, is there anything you think we may have missed?
No, I mean, I'm conscious of we've gone all over the place, and... you know, feel like there's been so much rich stuff there that it would be easy to carry on quizzing you and learning from you, Gwen. So we could easily talk for much longer, but I think probably now's the time to draw to a close, but really lovely to meet you.
That's a great pleasure to meet you too, Naomi. Great pleasure. You know, it's always nice to have conversations like this with colleagues. You know, your questions are very interesting ones, and I'm sorry, you know, that it's slightly one-sided, this conversation. I mean, I'd like to hear what you think about the Finns, you know, and about where some of those same questions about what the Finns holds for people, and indeed what your guys think about the Finns too. What they think about the process, the processes. Mm. So feels, I hope perhaps we can have another conversation, which I let you get a word in.
Okay.
Charles.
Lovely to see you.
Gwen. Nice to see you. Okay. Take care. Thanks very much.
And thanks a lot. Okay.
Bye.
A very interesting conversation with psychotherapist and psychiatrist Gwen Adsed. We covered a lot of ground. I'm just going to mention a couple of things in follow-up. Firstly, it's a long time since I heard anyone mention Thomas Satz, who was, after all, the leading figure in the field of anti-psychiatry when I was a young man. Secondly, I want to talk about two things that Gwen mentioned. One was not being noticed, and she gave an example of that in her description of how the Paddock unit, the DSPD, Dangerous and Severe Personality Disorder unit, was set up at Broadmoor, and the programme was developed, in her view, without any kind of recognition of the existing huge bank of experience and expertise in managing such individuals and such situations. And the programme was developed without that help and did indeed eventually fail. The other thing was the kind of opposite of that, which is how terrifying it is to be seen. And this is connected in Gwen's mind with the issue of shame and how difficult it is to expose what one thinks of as being the very worst parts of oneself to the gaze of others. Now it takes the summoning up of a tremendous amount of courage to expose oneself to that gaze, and how sometimes people just can't manage it.
Yeah, that was a really nice conversation. Really interesting, I thought, to hear Gwen's reflections on the different roles, and it sounded as though she was saying that psychotherapy offered the opportunity to have a richer, deeper connection with the patients than the role of psychiatrist would let her have. And obviously that was, it was that deeper connection that she was seeking from her involvement as a mental health professional. So yeah, interesting to hear that.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.